Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Over the coming weeks, this program will dedicate some hours to giving you the chance to speak directly with candidates in two important races, the 13th Congressional District race and the 52nd State Senate race. Today's guest is the Republican running for the latter office. John Babinick is a small business owner. He once worked for the University of Illinois. He's a conservative activist who characterizes his positions as fiscally responsible and socially conservative. He lives in Champaign and is seeking to represent portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties, including the cities of Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and portions of Danville in the Illinois Senate. This fall, he faces the Democratic incumbent in the 52nd District, Mike Frerichs, who is scheduled to appear on this program on October 1st. John Babinick, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm sure there's much that I can ask you. The purpose of this hour is to give our listeners a chance to question you directly. And I do hope that you will do so by phone at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-9455. WILL. We also welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. So now, while we're awaiting those calls and emails, and before we dive into various issues, I thought it might be helpful for our listeners to learn a little bit more about you outside of politics. So let's start with your business, Babinick Consulting. Mm-hmm. It's a cybercrime and electronic fraud prevention firm. How did you end up doing that for a living?
Well, that's essentially what I started my career doing when I graduated from the University of Illinois is in IT security. I actually started, my first job was in Ernst & Young, in the middle of when the auditing firm split out their technology consulting firm. So I was with three or four companies in the span of 6 months, but really never changed employers. So it's kind of an interesting time to be in Big Five consulting. You know, when I worked at U of I that you mentioned here, I did IT security. Haven't left U of I to take a private sector job, also doing that, and have my own firm doing kind of computer forensics or investigations, you know, on an as-needed basis. So that's pretty much what I've done professionally since leaving college, and it made a degree of sense to have my own firm to pick up business as it goes. It's essentially idle now because I'm spending most of my time campaigning.
Right.
But, you know, one way or the other, I'll get back to that after the election.
So you grew up in the Chicago suburbs?
Correct. I grew up in Elk Grove Village, which is essentially O'Hare Airport. So I learned to talk in 45-second spurts as planes flew overhead to land at O'Hare. Came down here for college to get my degree in theoretical astrophysics, and that's where I met my wife. This is where we started our family, so it's the first place we chose to live and have never left. So I've been here about 17 years now.
In general terms, how would you describe your political philosophy?
Well, you mentioned a little bit about it. You know, my ideas, I mean, government is needed for certain things, but in the end, it shouldn't go into things where it is not necessary. It should be, you know, minimally invasive as possible. But we also need to realize, you know, a lot of people talk, oh, we need government to protect against corporate greed. Well, we see here in the state of Illinois, there's also governmental greed, certainly with, you know, the conviction of Rod Blagojevich. So obviously, and I spent a lot of my time working on anti-corruption efforts. You know, the book I shared with you as I walked in here was for a campaign in 2008 for a constitutional convention. And that was the impetus, at least for my involvement, was it was before Rod Blagojevich was arrested. But how did a governor get to be that corrupt in a system that should have proper checks and balances to prevent that? And our Constitution failed to do it. So a lot of the efforts that I've been working on, you know, are tied to transparency, you know, redistricting reform, term limits, things that will help limit the corruption in government.
I want to get into some of those as we go along, but we already have some email questions for you from Rona, who asks, what would you like to see happen to help small businesses succeed?
Well, I think right now, because of the way Illinois policy is calibrated, you know, the first thing we need to do is stop doing harm. Kind of the pointed way I put it is we need to get the throat off the boot of Illinois government off the throats of small business and realize we need to compete for small businesses in other states. You know, if you can move your business across an arbitrary line on a map to Indiana and save $100,000 a year, we've got a problem. In Indiana, to set up a business, you walk in with a fee into one office, it's one-stop shopping. In Illinois, you know, the basic thing is, okay, you go to the Secretary of State for your Articles of Incorporation, you file it with a recorder, you've got to get a piece of paper from the Department of Revenue, maybe there's a professional license. We license many industries and professions that we don't need to be licensing. You know, if there's anything environmental, there's that. You know, we have all of these agencies and arms that are, got their claws into Illinois business, imposing costs that make us uncompetitive. With other states, you know, such as Indiana, Texas, and go through the whole litany.
The next question from Rona is, what's your stance on abortion? How will you try to adapt that to state law if you're elected?
Well, I would characterize myself as pro-life. Now, that said, Roe versus Wade certainly lays down exactly, you know, what the parameters of state law is. It's a federal fight because you're dealing with a U.S. Supreme Court opinion. As far as Illinois law is concerned, we mostly haven't had that many fights about abortion. There's still one current fight about parental notification and you know, sensible clinic regulations for abortion clinics. You know, there was a woman last week who died in an abortion clinic in Chicago, and actually a couple weeks ago. And there's some dispute about what the facts of that are, so I don't want to characterize whether it was negligence or whether regulations would help or whatever. But some of those things are there, that there are a lot of issues with regards to abortion where there is large consensus. If you pull parental notification, for instance, I believe it's something like 70-80%. So I certainly think that, you know, people who are pro-choice, pro-life, we can come to some consensus in state policy within the parameters of Roe versus Wade.
Rona has a few more questions. I want to get to those in just a second. But a reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. And today is the first of five shows in the coming weeks in which we offer you the chance to speak directly with candidates running for two key offices representing citizens of East Central Illinois, the 52nd State Senate District and the 13th Congressional District. Today we are talking with John Bambanek, the Republican candidate for State Senate, seeking to represent the 52nd District, which comprises portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties, including the cities of Champaign, Urbana-Rantoul, and portions of Danville. We welcome your questions for John Bambanek at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or again, you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And let's get back to these questions via email. What should Illinois do to avoid the image of corruption within our state government? What will you introduce to the State House if elected to help clean up things in our state?
Well, I mean, to limit the image of corruption, we need to stop being corrupt. You know, we have two of our last governors in federal prison. You know, this reputation is unfortunately earned over really at least a century of political corruption, whether it's in the city of Chicago or the state as a whole. I would argue that a lot of the reason that corruption continues to persist in Illinois is that Illinois law allows for it. You know, we have an expression of legal corruption, and as absurd as that might sound intellectually, we know that's kind of true in how Illinois operates day to day. You know, and our state's attorneys are very hamstrung in what they can do to prosecute that. You know, for Open Meetings Act, public bodies are supposed to meet in public and deliberate in public. We haven't. If you don't do that, there's criminal sanction if you don't. But we haven't had a prosecution under the Open Meetings Act since the 1970s. One of the reasons Illinois is a two-party consent state, meaning if I want to tape you, if we're having a conversation, you have to consent as well, is that in the late 70s, early 80s, a bunch of reporters caught, you know, basically did, you know, investigative reporting sting operation of legislators, says, you know, here's $2,000, whatever, I want this law, caught them on the take. And legislators' response to that overt corruption is, well, that should be illegal. They shouldn't be able to tape us without our permission. It's very hard to get a wiretap in a public corruption case under Illinois law. And if you take a look, you know, at our last two governors and all of those who have been indicted for corruption, no one has been indicted under state law. You know, Rob Blagojevich, George Ryan, federal prison. There's a city of Chicago alderman and a former Cook County commissioner under indictment right now. Federal indictments. You know, everybody says, you know, it's Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney up in the Northern District, which covers Chicago and the suburbs. He's the one prosecuting it. The question is, why aren't our state's attorneys doing it? There's local corruption, there's regional corruption, there's state corruption, and we need to empower not only our state's attorneys to go after this, we need to empower the media and members of the public to be able to find it. And that kind of goes into why my support of transparency. You put every dime online in real time, well, the major course, the major goal of corruption is to get money.
This does raise the sort of general philosophical question, which is what of these concepts should be dealt with at a federal level and what should be dealt with at state level? How do you decide when it comes from one issue to the next, corruption or otherwise, this should be handled by the state? This should be handled by local governments. This should be handled through federal law.
Well, I think the bulk of law enforcement in general should be local or state. I mean, our criminal code is state. You know, we should be doing the bulk of our law enforcement at the state or local level. The amount of criminal law should be limited. You know, that way you can tailor to whatever your communities, you know, and however you want to do it, because that's the most efficient layer to do it. So the fact that all, and one, I mean by all, I mean 100% of public corruption is handled by the federal government, and even then only one district of the U.S. attorneys. We have three U.S. attorneys for the state of Illinois. It allows for this kind of dysfunction and corruption to continue.
We have some more email questions to share with you, which we'll get to in a minute, but let's first go to a phone call. Susan is on the line from Urbana. Hi, Susan.
Hi. With regard to regulating abortion clinics, I don't see why they should be regulated any differently than any other kind of outpatient clinic or hospitals. Mm-hmm. There's a big push from some people, including some doctors. I was just reading about this in the Johns Hopkins University magazine, that there are efforts to make hospital deaths and outcomes more, health outcomes more transparent, mm-hmm. and to establish best practices. And I would submit that regulating abortion clinics by themselves does not make things safer for women. Mm-hmm. That if that was the goal, as opposed to trying to keep women from having abortions, that it would be better to make sure there's enough money for family planning and to have all health care clinics and hospitals evaluated and submitting information as to the best practices that they are following so that they do a better job. Mm-hmm. The other thing is about parental consent. The younger a teenager is, the more likely they are to have a parent involved, because this is often the first time that they have to deal with medical care on their own, and they're not very likely to try to get an abortion without some adult being involved to help them. For one thing, it costs money. For another thing, it's scary having somebody check out your private areas. The kind of person who's not going to be able to get parental consent is the kind of person who's in an abusive home. Mm-hmm. And there have been kids who have been killed by their parents.
Sure, sure.
Because the parent discovered that the kid was pregnant. That doesn't help anything. It's much better to have better sex education and have better access to family planning. But what I see people who would call themselves right-to-lifers doing is restricting access to family planning.
All right, Susan, I'm gonna stop you there just because I want to mm-hmm. give Mr. Bambanek a chance to respond. And you raised a couple of different points.
Sure. Yeah, and I was just taking notes, so I respond to. And I see three particular questions in there. The first was why regulate abortion clinics versus small healthcare facilities, and I would argue, and that's where it broke down when this was debated last year or the year before. Really, we need to, and I would agree, we need to regulate the outpatient facilities pretty much the same. You know, obviously, there's some particular aspects of abortion, particularly surgical abortion, that you want to take some extra due care to versus, say, over-the-counter stuff. But really, yes, we need to be regulating healthcare facilities to ensure people are safe, regardless of what kind of services they provide. The second part of your question is calibrating regulations so that healthcare is tied to good outcomes. And that's a relatively new aspect of healthcare policy, as I understand it. I certainly believe, and there's evidence to suggest, that we do a lot of healthcare that is not necessarily tied to good outcomes. It could be some of it's classified as defensive medicine, where you perform certain procedures or do certain tests or whatever, only for the purposes of avoiding a lawsuit or avoiding liability if there's a lawsuit filed. Well, that's wasted money. It's not beneficial. And anytime you have a medical intervention, there may be risks involved with that. So, yes, we need to move our healthcare system in general, so that we provide the services with the best outcomes at the most efficient cost. And we're going to start seeing good savings in Medicare, Medicaid, health insurance across the board. The last question you asked was specifically about parental notification. In the absolute sense, yes, there are parents who abuse their children, absolutely. But I think what is key and what we have noticed when this is studied is that if you have a young girl underage going to an abortion clinic or whatever to get help, they need to be, if they're an abused home, they need to be transferred to DCFS or referred to DCFS. So the agency, the law enforcement agency, most responsible to deal with the big problem that they're an abusive home, is informed and can take steps to get that child into safety and whatever means is necessary. So certainly, you know, we could talk about, you know, some kind of exemption for an abusive home. But what we need to make sure is that, you know, if you have a young child, you know, who's 12 years old, impregnated by a stepfather or whatever, DCFS needs to be involved, and we need to get that child out of that abusive situation. That is the most important priority.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and as part of our effort to better inform you in advance of the November election, we're offering you a chance to speak directly with all of the candidates in a couple of key races here in Central Illinois. In the coming weeks, we'll talk with candidates in both the 13th Congressional District race and the 52nd State Senate District race, and we're starting today with the Republican seeking to represent the 52nd District in the Illinois Senate, John Babinec. The 52nd District includes portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties, including the cities of Champaign, Urbana-Rantoul, and portions of Danville. While I'm happy to throw out some questions of my own, really this hour is for you, so I encourage you to call with questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email them to will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handles, Will Public Media. That phone number again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we have... couple more questions from Rona. Let's knock these out and then move on to some others. Rona asks, do you agree with the illegal immigrant stance of President Obama? How will that affect your voting within the House? And of course, in this case, it would be with the state Senate. And so the question is, any immigration policies that apply to the state?
Sure. Well, I mean, immigration, by and large, is a federal question. I think the fundamental problem with immigration, now speaking as a matter of opinion, not a state policy, is that we have laws on the books that we don't enforce. And when you do that, I mean, and we have a means to change laws. We're long overdue for a debate about immigration, but let's do that in Congress, not with the executive branch, not enforcing immigration law, which has caused all sorts of problems on the border states, caused all sorts of issues with labor law and all these extra costs in terms of how we do welfare in the various states. As a matter of state policy, you know, there isn't much that we deal with immigration. You know, for the most part, like Arizona's strong immigration statute, I believe, you know, portions are struck down, portions were enacted. So I know that that debate comes up in the Illinois every now and then. But we also need to not give a better deal to illegal immigrants than we give to our own citizens. Again, that kind of goes into welfare spending. We've noticed when studied, there is a fair amount of Medicaid recipients, and this is public health, that do not live in Illinois, are not our citizens, not our taxpayers, but they're getting health care benefits out of our state. We need to do things to tamp down on that to make sure that we're taking care of our own citizens first and foremost, because that's what the taxpayers are spending the money to Springfield to do.
And Rona's last question, if elected and you find out that the majority of your constituents do not agree with your stance on a topic, will you vote according to your constituents or according to your own conscience?
Well, it depends. If it's a matter of principle, you know, there's something that Governor Chris Christie said at the Republican convention, is that real leaders don't follow polls, they shape polls. You know, there are matters of principle that I will be, you know, less than flexible on. For instance, corruption. If somebody's stealing in state government and people are okay with it, hypothetically, I would imagine that they're not. You know, it's still theft. It's wrong. And I would not stand for it. Now, there are plenty of issues within the parameters of those principles that we can work together and find solutions on matters of public policy. But I think the voters want to see somebody who can articulate their principles, who are looking out for the best interests of their citizens. And that's really the guiding light in terms of public policy I have. What do I think will be best for the voters of this district? What do I think will be best for the children and the next generation of this district? And that's what I will always seek to try to do, barring any kind of other political concerns.
Our next question is also via email from Kathleen in Urbana, asking how you feel about Constitutional Amendment Number 49, which is designed to take away the constitutional protections for state pensions.
I believe what she's asking about is that this November you will see a constitutional amendment on the ballot. The voters get to vote for it, and if 60% say yes, it will be part of our state constitution. What they will see on the ballot is that it will require a 3/5 vote for any pension benefit increase. The selling point in the General Assembly when this was debated was over the past 30 or 40 years, this General Assembly has voted for pension sweeteners and other things that it never funded, never paid for. And this is particularly a big problem for local pensions, where the state doesn't contribute anything but dictated benefit increases, and that caused all sorts of problems with municipal finance. What you will not see on there, and you know, you'll see some articles from Professor John Kint out of, well, he's a retired professor now at U of I, was the way that it was phrased and the way that it was passed out of the General Assembly. It wasn't written by the lawyers at a General Assembly. It was written by a third-party law firm. Is that his opinion is that it seems to undermine the constitutional protection in the state constitution for pension benefits. You know, there's some merit to his idea. He certainly has some expertise that I don't. But, you know, kind of as a matter of transparency, if you want to pass a constitutional amendment that requires 3/5 of a vote for a public benefit, pension benefit increase, that amendment should be 2 sentences. This amendment that voters are going to be voting on is 3 pages. And whenever you see something that could be said in 2 sentences, take 3 pages or 2,000 pages, you know there's going to be problems that are not intended to be seen involved in that. And that goes to some of the, you know, transparency issues in the legislative process, some of the games that they play there that need to stop.
Well, what's interesting, at the time, your opponent, the incumbent senator, mm-hmm. Mike Ferrix, he was one of a couple of senators who voted against it.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, you disagreed with him, right?
Right. As far as I knew, the debate was that 3/5 pension vote for a pension benefit increase. And I think there's some certain benefit to requiring a supermajority to increase pension benefits. It's a form of borrowing. You're giving benefits you have to pay in the future. We have that supermajority for debt. That policy makes sense.
Now that you know the way the language mm-hmm. wound up mm-hmm. and understanding that it's so lengthy and maybe complicated and maybe mm-hmm. has some issues, do you understand his vote now?
When I actually called him about that, and I think we talked personally about it briefly, not very long, I don't think anybody really understood some of the nuances in this that Professor Kint has brought up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I think going forward, you know, there'll be some groups out there that'll do some education. I'll participate where appropriate and make sure that voters at least make an informed decision about what the true impacts of this amendment are, so that they can make an informed choice about whether to support that amendment or not. Fundamentally, I believe the state constitution is the people's document. It is not a document of the General Assembly or the political leadership or the governor. So ultimately, the right, you know, to amend the constitution belongs to them. But, you know, we should make sure that we're not trying to play games and hide from them the truth of what this amendment could do.
So in terms of the basic concept of requiring a 3/5 majority mm-hmm. vote to increase funding for pensions, that's something that if it were just that on its face, you would support that.
Yeah. I think the General Assembly has proven that it is an irresponsible steward of the pensions, whole and entire. In the last 6 years, just 6 years, the pensions have gone from about 70% funded to about 40% funded. A lot of that has to do with pension holidays. A lot of that has to do with some of these unfunded benefit increases. Some of that has to do with the General Assembly made it possible for people who are not government employees to get government pensions. If you look at 4 of the top 100 pensions in the top 5 state systems, those 4 are not government employees. Why is a public pension being paid to somebody who never worked for government? And why is that not criminal? You know, that's pension theft, and it was enabled by the General Assembly. So there needs to be some restriction of the discretion on the General Assembly, who over the last few decades has not funded this system, even though they knew what they needed to do to fund it. You know, one of the reforms, the key reform I want is that however these pensions get awarded, there needs to be full real-time funding of the full actuarial required contribution in real time on a non-discretionary basis. If you award a pension benefit for 1 year of credit, that 1 year of credit needs to be funded by the state in real time, not subject to the discretion of the General Assembly in the political process, which has shown that it will always fail to do what's right in regards to the pensions.
But getting back to the whole three-fifths idea, there's so much consternation at the federal level over how the U.S. Senate's rules essentially require a three-fifths majority to defeat merely the threat of a filibuster.
Sure.
And how that's held up so much in Congress. Do you have any qualms about creating rules for something like pensions at the state level that basically mirror that concept of, well, now we need to get so many more votes all on one side to... Well, that majority is not enough to rule all of a sudden.
Well, there's a case for it in limited circumstances. I mean, yeah, and we could talk about the abuse of the filibuster by both parties, and it has been abused, you know. But on the flip side, for instance, it takes a supermajority to amend the U.S. Constitution. Well, something as important as our federal constitution, there should be additional checks there to make sure that what we're doing is done in a thoughtful and discerning way. And in under a state constitution, overriding a governor's veto takes a supermajority. Borrowing takes a supermajority. There are cases in doing it in very limited ways to make sure things are done where there's broad consensus. And when you are obligating billions of dollars over the long term, over a term longer than almost all of these General Assembly members will serve, you know, there needs to be, you know, an added check in there, whether it's three-fifths or some other check. I mean, we could talk about how that is in concept. I support three-fifths. But however we put that scrutiny and discernment in so that the decisions made in regards to the pension system do not keep resulting in this underfunding that's caused a state fiscal crisis.
We have a question on Twitter asking what you think of jaywalking tickets being given out in Champaign-Urbana to minorities. And this is a reference to a story from Hoy Chicago that has been they've been examining this issue, that there's a concern over whether or not tickets are being given out in this one particular intersection neighborhood for jaywalking where there aren't any sidewalks, as it turns out.
Yeah, I saw the headline, so I can't speak with great intelligence about the facts of the article. But, you know, as a matter of general principle, you know, the law should be colorblind and enforced equally and fairly. You know, if there happens to be a problem at a certain intersection where pedestrians are blocking the flow of traffic and causing a safety issue, you know, that's one thing. If there's targeting or whatever, that's another. I do know that there are significant racial concerns here in Champaign, in particular, about law enforcement and whether it's disproportionately targeting African Americans or minorities. And that is a problem. We need to make sure that ultimately law enforcement is enforced the same for all without regards to race.
Today is the first of five shows in the coming weeks here on Focus in which we're offering you the chance to speak directly with candidates running for two key offices representing citizens of East Central Illinois, the 52nd State Senate District and the 13th Congressional District. And today we are talking with John Babinek. He's the Republican candidate for State Senate seeking to represent the 52nd District, which comprises portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties, including the cities of Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and portions of Danville. And as I've said, I'd love to continue talking with Mr. Babinek, but really the goal of this hour is to hear from you, to hear your questions, and so we hope you'll call us this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. We're due to take a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, comic W. Kamau Bell, host of the FX series Totally Biased, which brings an African-American perspective to political comedy. On one of Bell's comedy tours, to attract a multicultural audience, he made this offer.
If you bring a friend of a different race, you get in two for one.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available on the Corkscrew's Facebook page.
You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking today with John Babinick. He is the Republican candidate for state Senate seeking to represent the 52nd district that comprises portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties. That includes the cities of Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, as well as portions of Danville. We welcome your questions for John Babinick this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I don't want to leave pensions behind without asking just a simple question. Mm-hmm. What would you do to reduce the ever higher cost of pensions, or what would you do to try and close the gap so that we can afford the pensions that are already promised?
Well, I think, you know, kind of dividing our state annual pension payment into its constituent parts will kind of show you where this problem is. Last year's state pension payment to fully fund the systems was $5.5 billion. Of that, only $1 billion was needed to fund the pension benefits conferred that year. The rest was debt. That tells you where we need to solve this problem. If we simply said no more pensions ever again and forget the fact we'd have to pay Social Security, we'd still have a pension payment of $4.5 billion. You know, that problem is only going to be solved by paying it down over time and not making the problem worse by underfunding, not making the problem worse by, you know, unfunded mandates of various things, and going after the people who illegitimately have claimed pension benefits they should not be entitled to.
We have a follow-up email from Kathleen regarding pensions, and she says, the employees of the state of Illinois did not write the exceptions to the pension rules mm-hmm. that resulted in the egregious pensions paid to some unworthies. She says, the state legislature of which you wish mm-hmm. to belong wrote those exceptions. She asks, do you imagine that employees who paid in 6% or 8% of their salaries would have said, sure, let's get a big shot lobbyist work for a month and have his pension jacked up by 150%? She says, no, we would not. It's the state legislature who wrote those rules.
Oh, no, it's very clear maybe I'm not being clear. The blame lies in the state legislature. They have created this problem whole and entire. Both parties are involved in it. You know, this is not, the Democrats did this, you know, or, the, you know, both parties or members of both parties had their hand in doing this. And, yeah, you know, some of these pension exceptions for lobbyists and the like, even reading the law that was passed, I couldn't exactly find where the language is where somebody would substitute teach for one day in Macon County and then claim a 20-year pension based on their union service. Of course, that was the General Assembly. And if this happened in the private sector, somebody would be in prison. And that is what's wrong in the General Assembly. They can engage in these wanton acts of corruption without consequence. And now it's time to hold them accountable for their bad behavior.
Do you think it's possible to come up with a solution if the concern is that it's the legislature that has created this problem?
Mm-hmm.
How do we ask the legislature to resolve the problem?
Well, I think first and foremost, the legislature could say we illegitimately conferred these benefits to people who aren't government employees and we're not going to give them to you anymore, and let it play out in the courts. There was a debate that I made reference to. This person who substitute taught in Macon County for one day claimed his entire union service as creditable pension credits and had a six-figure pension. Well, the legislature came in and said, you know what, you're not getting anything anymore. Period, end of story. Go to court if you don't like it. And that person did not. So I think we need to, like I said, first and foremost, we need to go after those bad actors. Now, obviously, there's legislators you can hold to account for this. And there's the individuals who are claiming these unearned pension benefits, and they need to be taken away from them.
Let's take another call. We have Ann on the line from Champaign. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. I was wondering what your position was on gambling in mm-hmm. Illinois. Our governor seems to have a different position mm-hmm. in the legislature, and also how you feel about all the gambling in Danville, all the casinos and stuff.
Sure. So I think I'll take a minute to kind of describe the lay of the land. I mean, obviously, the General Assembly approved gambling expansion. It includes slots at the tracks, five new casinos, various other measures. The governor vetoed that proposition. His stated reason for doing it is that he wanted to see an outright contribution ban, a campaign contribution ban, from gaming interests to politicians. I believe is that the governor's opposition to this bill is less of a matter of principle, and the more the matter is that many of his campaign contributors are owners of suburban casinos who would be harmed by a city-owned casino in the city of Chicago. I think the city owning, or any government entity owning something that directly competes with private enterprise is always a problem. And the city of Chicago owning a gambling institution is a problem, considering they still have corruption problems. That said, my concern with gambling in the community of Danville in particular, and this is usually being sold as an economic development plan, and I'm concerned about that too. I have 3 children, 5, 3, and 1. And when they grow up, the jobs I want them to have, the jobs that I want to be available to them, is not to be a bouncer or a cocktail waitress. If you look at some of the other cities in Illinois that have had casinos built over the recent years, under the same guise of economic development, Elgin, East Peoria, Metro East, these communities are no better off having the casinos than not, and you can make an argument that they are worse off. The state law itself suggests that there are problems, because anytime a county gets a casino, the state funds an extra assistant state's attorney for that county to handle prosecuting additional crime. We tacitly accept the fact that there will be an increase of crime with gambling. I don't think gambling is an economic development plan. In fact, I think it's kind of the last refuge of people whose economic policies have failed, and we need to do the real work to turn around the Illinois economy and not relying on casinos to do the job when they have historically failed to do it.
Let's go next to an email from Nick. He asks, what do you think about the California ballot initiative to require the labeling of genetically modified food products, and would you support such an initiative in Illinois?
I can't really speak to great intelligence about that ballot initiative. I know there's some concerns about GMOs in general. As a matter of economic policy, I always support businesses engaging in full disclosure of their products and what's there, particularly if there's health concerns. I mean, we do label, ingredients for people with allergies, health stuff, vitamin A, so on and so forth. I think consumers, and anytime there's a transaction, you need to make sure that it's a fully informed transaction so that there's not abuse there. So in general, I'd be inclined to say, there needs to be some kind of full disclosure of people who make foods, of what's in them, what constitutes them, so that they can make an appropriately informed consumer choice.
We learned earlier this week that Chicago-based McDonald's is going to start labeling calorie counts on all of their menu items.
I believe that's required by state law.
Okay.
I believe that last year we passed a law requiring some of this nutrition information to be available.
At the national level, it's not yet gone into effect that those requirements are necessary, but there will be new federal regulations dealing with that. So they're just sort of getting maybe a little bit ahead of that. Do you think that that's a role that government should play to demonstrate not only here's what businesses can say are available goods and services, but here are the ones that are good for you and here are the ones that are bad for you? Should that be a role government should play?
There's a case, with the preamble of the federal constitution to promote the general welfare, you can interpret that as saying, to provide some general health information. I mean, we have an FDA based on that requirement. But on the flip side, it can also get quite excessive. I think beyond requiring disclosure, I don't really think the government should be in the interest or in the business of saying, hey, you stop drinking pop or getting involved in people's lives.
So I guess you disagreed with Mayor Bloomberg's conclusion in New York about sugary drinks and setting limits on what people can purchase.
Well, I don't think that, the mayor of the city of New York or any government official is empowered with, special dispensation from on high to tell people how to live their lives. Part of the consequences of being in a free country where people have free speech, free association, so on and so forth, is that they make decisions that we disagree with. But the alternative is that we are not free, and then somebody else decides what decisions we can make, and historically that has not worked out too well for the individual. So by and large, I mean, I believe in individual freedom. People make choices I disagree with all the time. I may make choices they disagree with all the time. We have to live together. Who cares? You know, only in cases when you're involving crime. No, you can't shoot somebody. You know, we're going to put you in prison for that. Or some of those extreme circumstances, really, should we get government involvement? I mean, aside of full disclosure of what you're doing, because consumers have a right to know what kind of transaction they're entering into. Beyond that, I don't think really government has much of a role at all unless there's, you know, an extreme safety issue involved.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and as part of our effort to better inform you in advance of the November election, we're offering you a chance to speak directly with all of the candidates in a couple of key offices here in Central Illinois. In the coming weeks, we'll talk with candidates in both the 13th Congressional District race and the 52nd State Senate District race, and we're starting today with the Republican seeking to represent the 52nd District in the Illinois Senate, John Bambanek. The 52nd District includes portions of Champaign and Vermilion counties. It includes the cities of Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and portions of Danville. There is still time for your questions for Mr. Bambanek at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Next up is Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Yeah, at the beginning you were talking about corporate greed, and you said that some people say government's necessary to prevent that, and you gave the example of Blagojevich as being government greed. But if my recollection is correct, you know, the then Republican Party had Cellini and Resnick were, you know, they were scamming for a large corporation.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not, they aren't mutually exclusive. And what I see, and a lot of people see, that corporations have captured government, and that's one of the worst situations we can be. And then less government, less bad government's a good idea for sure, but less government, period, is not a solution to what I see. But I had a broader question about your philosophy. Paul Ryan keeps peddling this line about how he doesn't want the safety net to be a hammock, and he really likes it because he's used it when he rolled out both of his budgets, and he, I think he even used it in his acceptance speech or in some variation. And in a country where so many people, one out of six individuals are in poverty, one out of five, or in, I think in Illinois it's higher than that, children are in poverty, what kind, and a lot of the safety net has already been eviscerated. It seems to me just so out of touch, and to, I think you're going to probably disavow that particular rhetorical gambit, maybe not, but it just seems surreal to have people who are so out of touch, Romney lampooning the rising of the sea when so many people in southern Louisiana were underwater at the time. It seems like the height of insensitivity, and I just had to rant.
No, that's fair. As far as Ryan, Congressman Ryan and Governor Romney's particular statements, I mean, at a certain point, you as a voter hold them accountable for what they have to say. I must confess, running for office, I really don't have time to listen to many of the federal speeches, so I can't speak with great intelligence on that. But to your first question about less government, you're absolutely right about the conclusion of, at least in Illinois, of business and government to take money out of the public system and to enrich business interests. That's very much not mutually exclusive, I think. In a large part, when you have a government that's so big that it can do that, I think that's the factor of big government and unaccountable government that we need to get rid of. And there's plenty of examples to that.
Let's see how many more calls we can get in here. We have Walt on the line from Champaign. Walt, go ahead.
Good morning. I was wondering, and I don't know if you already touched on this topic or not, but the corn ethanol problem, the subsidy of corn ethanol production, and the effect that's having, especially after a drought.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing I wanted to ask about was the proposal to put a PCB, toxic chemical dump, in Clinton on top of the Mahomet Aquifer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for
the
calls.
All right. First question on subsidies. In general, and I guess here's my approach to state budgeting, whole and entire, and I'll get to the question of subsidies in a second, is that we look at government and say, okay, what couple areas are you going to cut? our budget is so broken, Illinois is broken, that we need to fundamentally rethink how we do budgeting. And I subscribe to a philosophy of what's called zero-based budgeting. You start with zero, and then you figure out what are your absolute have-tos, what are your highest priorities, and how do you do that in the most efficient way possible that maximizes the return on value to the taxpayers. I'll give you an example of how that can be shown to be bad. There's a program called Grow Your Own Teachers, we need teachers. We need them in the inner cities. Absolutely. I would agree with that goal. However, this program spends over $660,000 per teacher that it's brought out of the system. Well, I think we could say that that system is not economically effective. We need to find ways to achieve our objectives in an economically efficient way. I tend to be reluctant for subsidies in general. I think we should make a system where things make economic sense without an intervention of state government. The last question of PCBs over the Muhammad Aquifer, I'm not sure why that's the only location for PCBs is over a water source that's key to this area. Why it can't be put anywhere else? But as far as my particular threshold, they would have to guarantee an absolute 100% degree of safety and assurance that that would never enter the water source and pose a health risk to our community. And I think the EPA is looking at that. Some of the Illinois environmental regulatory agencies are looking at that. I believe that is their threshold as well, based on some laws that have passed both out of Congress and the state legislature. They appear to be working, because there's certainly a lot of scrutiny, a lot of study into this stuff, and we'll have to see what those bodies decide. I mean, I think the legislator created these systems. Let's see how they work before intervening prematurely.
You said that you are generally not a fan of subsidies, but what about specifically ethanol?
Oh, someone would have to show me that the particular economic benefit. I don't think that ethanol as a producing quantity for fuel has rise to the level where it needs to be efficient to be a cost-effective alternative. Certainly subsidizing additional research to see if we can get it there. Subsidizing research is obviously, a different animal altogether. But I don't want to get in the business of targeting specific subsidies. I want to get in target of we need to get control of our entire budget. Everybody is going to have to reevaluate what they're doing. And I'm not going to say we're going to target X group, we're going to target Y group. We're going to target the whole state budget. We're going to look at our objectives. We're going to do it responsibly. And there's going to be belt tightening across the board.
What if it does spur significant economic growth?
Let's put it this way.
Yeah.
For every dollar the state of Illinois spends, if you can show me that more than a dollar of value is returned to the taxpayers, that's good spending.
Return to the taxpayers or return to the economy as a whole?
Well, return to the value of the taxpayers. I mean, there's some spending that doesn't necessarily spur the economy, or at least not in a direct sense. I mean, law enforcement doesn't right. spur the economy, but, I mean, you could do over law enforcement also. So it has to return a dollar of value back to the taxpayers, at least a dollar of value back to the taxpayers.
All right. I want to try and get at least one more call. We have Lewis on the line from Chicago. Lewis, go ahead.
Yes, maybe you covered this topic before, but there's a lot of politicians are pushing the expansion of gambling, which I'm opposed, and I know mm-hmm. people on both sides of the spectrum are opposed to it. And I was just wondering, what is your opinion on this? I know they're planning to build one mm-hmm. near Champaign, too,
sure.
at a college.
Yeah.
We did talk about it before, but if you want to reiterate.
Essentially, gambling is never really an economic development plan. I mean, it comes with the attendant crime, but, the jobs we need to be creating for people. I mean, there'd be jobs to build a casino, and construction jobs are good, but jobs of, cocktail waitresses as bouncers is not what we need to be creating for our children.
All right, and let's get in one more call. James is in Champaign. James, go ahead.
Yes, we have a situation whereby in the last 3 decades the prison population has quintupled mm-hmm. while the general population has only increased by 13%. So I'm assuming, since you are in favor of small government, that you would like to see that pared back. And in particular, I'm wondering how you would also address the fact that about 58% of the people who are incarcerated are African Americans, who only represent about 15% of the population in the state. So, I mean, do you think that that racial discrepancy is something that government should try to address, or do you take a hands-off attitude and say that that's the way the market forces have shaped things?
All right.
Well, I guess as far as prison population, the latest numbers I've seen from a couple of months ago, we house 48,000 inmates in a system designed for 33,000. You know, ultimately, the state government and our local governments need to ensure the safety of citizens. If that's a real factor of violent crime of people that pose a public safety risk, then we simply need to build more prisons. There's a case every now and then that we need to spend more money to ensure, you know, public safety. I suspect many of those are involved with, you know, drug issues. I know in Champaign County in particular, we have a drug court where we try to, you know, take those who are involved with drugs, who interact with the criminal justice system, get them treatment, because the problem ultimately is their addiction to drugs. You know, we're just starting up a mental health court. You know, if somebody has mental health problems that lead to an involvement with the criminal justice system, we try to get them the help we deserve. As far as the disproportionate ratio of people in prison, I certainly think government should try to understand that problem and come to a real understanding so that we can decide and tailor what can be done about that. If it's racial profiling, then it needs to be ended and stopped. If there's other things that government is doing or not doing that can help address this problem, there's certainly things we can discuss.
We have come to the end of our hour. Before we wrap up, tell us one thing about you that you feel like voters should know about you that they seem not to.
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think, for the most part, the big reason of why I'm running is, the state debt, the state finances. If you divide the state debt up by every man, woman, and child, you get $31,600. You know, that's to each of my three kids. That's unacceptable. After the tax hike that was passed in the middle of the night last year, did nothing to ensure fiscal stability of our state. And we really need to do better, get control of our state finances, and bring jobs back to this district.
We'll have to leave it there. John Babinich is the Republican nominee for the 52nd State Senate District in Illinois. He faces incumbent Democrat Mike Frericks in November. John, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, we'll welcome your questions on children's health for Dr. Malcolm Hill, a pediatrician from Carl in Urbana. Dr. Hill can respond to a range of concerns, anything from vaccinations and common childhood illnesses to coping with minor bumps and bruises. Any problem you might discuss with your own family doctor is welcome. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show was produced by Travis Stansel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handles your calls. Thanks for joining us. I'm Craig Cohen.